You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Not Watford, Richard, in Harpenden in Hertfordshire on a very chilly early December morning. We wouldn't be able to get into Watford anyway because of the NATO summit taking place at the Grove. Donald Trump, obviously a huge figure in the world of cycling, having organised and run the Tour de Trump in the USA in the, late 80s and early 90s?
Early 90s, I think.
Yeah, he's in Watford, actual Watford today, at the Grove. I wonder if he'll have time for a round of golf. Might be able to cheat his way to beating my score.
There's that great story, isn't there, about Trump, who was attending a dinner, I think, in New York, and Greg LeMond was there, and LeMond said hello, and LeMond had ridden the Tour de Trump, and Trump, when he then took to the stage, said, well ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by cycling royalty today, please give it up for Lance Armstrong.
Yeah, oh dear.
Greg LeMond told you that story, didn't he, in an episode of Kilometre Zero last year?
He did. Oh, a few years ago that was in the wake of Brexit. I decided to split opinion by making an episode about the Tour de France and politics, and Donald Trump featured in that because he put his name to the Tour de Trump when cycling was a big sort of the coming sport in the US, wasn't it?
You're a bit Trump-esque this morning when you arrived, talking about the golf course that they're at, saying you played your greatest round ever.
Yeah, I put together a really solid back nine of about 46.
Where's Daniel?
Well, we don't know.
He's gone missing since the tour.
Yeah, he made it to our Champs-Élysées of our Grand Tour in Manchester. And the last I saw of him was at the Mercure Hotel in Manchester on Saturday night after our triumphant final stage of the Grand Tour. Thank you very much to everyone who came along, including Daniel. Daniel came along for a few stages, didn't he, in the second week. What a great experience that was. 11 brilliant nights. All very different, I felt.
It was great, and we learned a lot, I think, about we did our thing in places like in Manchester. It was like a music concert hall, similarly in Cambridge, and then there were others where it was a really intimate little theatre where the wall of people in front of you were really felt like they were bearing down on you, and that had a big impact on how it went. I think one of those, I mean, I enjoyed them all. Leicester was great with Colin Sturgis. In Manchester we were joined by Lizzie Banks and Adam Blythe, and that was really good. When we had guests there, it was quite different, but yeah, it was great fun. And you will be able to hear some of the best of our live shows in a forthcoming Friends special episode, and there'll be news later in this episode on how you sign up as a friend for 2020, and we'll also hear a clip.
Yeah, just on the tour, I mean, it's the biggest and most ambitious thing we've done, and I think it evolved over the 11 events, didn't it? And as you say, I think we became a bit more confident, and we got to grips more with what we were doing. I certainly felt more comfortable in the sort of smaller, more intimate venues. Bristol was fantastic as an actual venue, I'm talking about. Similarly, Worcester and Belfast as well. I don't know, they were places where I felt really at home. And in the bigger venues, maybe the nerves took over a little bit more, but I'm talking personally there, but I've always thought that the riders make the race rather than the course, but maybe the venue makes the event. And but it was so nice to meet so many people afterwards when we were signing the Grand Tour diaries, and chance to meet people whose names I only know from either social media or our Facebook discussion group or people who've emailed in. But it was, yeah, a really memorable couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll do it again in 2020.
And for me, a highlight was the very final question, and it wasn't really a question. In Manchester on Saturday night, a gentleman with a white stick who said he's visually impaired, and just that following the podcast brings the race to life for him, that's his mental picture of the race that we're providing through the podcast. That was very moving, actually, and it was a great note to end it on.
Yeah, it was, and I think it made me, I came off stage kind of feeling that, you know, with that, reminding myself that that is what we try to do at the Grand Tours, is to paint a visual picture, because although that gentleman partially sighted and presumably not watching the racing on TV, you know, we're trying to describe something in audio to all of our listeners. So yeah, that was a really nice note to end on, and if you're listening, thank you very much. That really kind of made our night and made our tour.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Big thanks to Ratha, our headline sponsor, and a poignant thanks, because that's one of the final, this is one of the final times we'll hear that jingle, and one of the final times I'll say thanks to Ratha for their title sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. It's a end of an era, isn't it, Lionel? We are going our separate ways at the end of the year after 3.5 glorious years, and can't really overstate how important Rafa's support has been for us over 3.5 years. They came in midway through 2016 and they enabled us to cover the Giro Tour and Vuelta. Well, they came in after the Giro in time for the Tour that year, and each year since then they've enabled us to provide daily coverage from the three Grand Tours, as well as lots of other things besides. So extremely grateful to them for their long-standing support.
Well, yeah, I mean, giving us the stability and the security to cover the three Grand Tours on the ground is obviously a huge part of what we do, but that support also enabled you to develop the Cycling Podcast Feminine as well, and expand on that. We've also been able to do a series of Explore, which will be coming back in 2020. More on that in a future podcast. And that's our series about kind of endurance riding, bike packing, and just generally getting out and riding and exploring the world. And Service Course as well, the tech show that's not a tech show, hosted by Tom Whalley and Lizzie Banks. And we wouldn't have been able to develop any of those things without that security of the long-term sponsorship. So a huge thank you, particularly to Simon Mottram, the man behind Rafa, but also everyone who's supported us from Rafa over the last 3.5 years.
Don't worry, podcast is not going anywhere. It does mean, however, that we can't afford anymore to keep three presenters on the regular show. So one of us will have to go. And we're putting to the public, phone 55566771 if you want to get rid of Lionel.
Come off it. That's not a real, although maybe we could do a crowd funded premium rate phone line, and that could be our alternative sponsorship. No, we're not going to get rid of anyone, are we? Or is that why Daniel's not here?
Oh, well, he's got the axe already. No, we're not getting rid of anyone, and things will carry on as normal. But we are very, very grateful indeed to Rafa, and as Lionel says, in particular to Simon Mottram, who came to our second show in London, and it was great to see him there. On with the news roundup, Lionel.
Okay, Richard. Well, a few little bits and pieces knocking around in the world of cycling. Finally, the big transfer that we've been anticipating for a long time now. Sam Bennett, the Irish rider, moving from Bora Hansgrohe to De Koninck Quickstep, along with his good mate Shane Archbold, the Flying Mullet. That is finally official. So Sam Bennett will be riding in the blue and white of De Koninck Quickstep next season. Sticking with Bora Hansgrohe, Peter Sagan had long been rumoured to be tackling the Giro and the Tour next year. That's been confirmed. He'll also go to the Olympic Games in Tokyo. Surprise for me, anyway, is that Pascal Ackermann will do the Giro and the Vuelta. I thought he would perhaps have, been given the opportunity to ride at the Tour de France next year with Sagan doing both the Giro and the Tour. Clearly not at this stage.
It's intriguing to wonder how that will work at the Giro, because you've got two sprinters. Okay, Sagan is not a pure sprinter, but is he going to help Ackermann there, or Ackermann going to help him? I mean, it's a very formidable lineup, having both of them, but I'm curious to see how that will work.
It's going to be really interesting, that. They've got an embarrassment of riches, really, even with Sam Bennett departing, because they've also got Emmanuel Buchmann for the overall at the Tour de France. So, yeah, teams are starting to unveil their plans for 2020.
And something that will be very close to your heart, Lionel, so I saw someone pointing out on Twitter that given De Koninck Quickstep's tradition of really honouring the national champions jersey, they do a bit like FDJ, they don't, it's not just a token effort. And we heard Adam Blythe at the weekend talking about his battles to have a pure, clean national champions jersey. Well, just on that, actually, we asked Adam Blythe and Lizzie Banks to bring three jerseys, each with a story behind it, to our event in Manchester. And Adam walked on stage with a Waitrose bag and pulled out his national champions jersey, Tinkoff, the Tinkoff version, then another version of the national champions jersey, and then a third version of the national champions jersey. So clearly it means a lot to him. But he said that at Tinkoff there was a lot of pressure to make it yellow with little red and blue flashes. They kind of quick step do honour the national champions, don't they? So we'll see the full Irish flag on Sam Bennett. But remember the twist on that they gave Elia Viviani at the Giro this year, so who knows?
Yeah, that was awful. The vertical stripes rather than the horizontal stripes.
It didn't work, did it?
It didn't work. It looked like a Carlisle United away shirt.
Slowed them down.
From the late 90s. Sticking with Italy, as you mentioned Italy there, there's been a landslide on the Poggio, the final battleground, the springboard for Milan-San Remo. And early reports are that it might cost as much as €10 million to get the road reopened. So there may well be some negotiations between RCS, the race organisers, and the local authorities there, because that is a considerable outlay and not a lot of time to get the road repaired and back into use by traffic. So we will watch and wait. That would be a real jolt to Milan-San Remo if the Poggio was not passable.
I already had Sam Bennett down as one of the favourites from Milan-San Remo, but if the Poggio's missing, I would put him as an even stronger favourite.
Yeah, but if the Poggio's missing, that might then bring the even, you know, purer sprinters into play. This is deep into the world of speculation here. We don't do this, but we will watch on that. Julian Alaphilippe is going to ride the Tour of Flanders in 2020. I think Francois Tomaso revealed that during our tour, and that has been in the news a little bit this week. Alaphilippe has won the Velo d'Or, arguably the most prestigious annual prize in professional cycling, I think. I mean, there's several of these awards, isn't there? The Flandrian of the Year, an international Flandrian of the Year, awarded by Het Nieuwsblad in Belgium, of course. But the Velo d'Or has been going since 1992. It's awarded by Velo magazine in France. The jury is made up of a bunch of international journalists, and Alaphilippe, a deserving winner, one Milan-San Remo, one Flèche Wallonne, one Strade Bianche, also led the Tour de France for a couple of weeks, and he won the vote ahead of Egan Bernal, Primoz Roglic, Mathieu van der Poel and Annemiek van Vleuten. Any complaints about that result? Alaphilippe fully deserving, Rich?
Yeah, I think so. Bernal's the other, I mean, Roglic as well. I think Alaphilippe, for not just the wins, but the way that he lit up the Tour de France, I think that will have curried favour for him.
Yeah, and also the diversity of his wins. Milan-San Remo, a real long, tough classic. Flèche Wallonne, a brutal uphill sprint. Strade Bianche on the white roads, of course. And the Tour, the biggest Grand Tour. I mean, he's pretty much done something across the board this year. So, Alaphilippe, Rider of the Year. A couple of bits of transfer news. A young British rider, Ethan Hayter, is joining Team Ineos for next year. And, Davide Rebellin. During our tour, I was wearing my Extinction Rebellin t-shirt on a couple of nights. Daniel made that joke in the podcast a few weeks ago when we were in central London and there were helicopters overhead, which were presumably part of the security effort around the Extinction Rebellion climate change protest.
Not to be confused, those
no,
two.
Not to be confused. I'm not making light of Extinction Rebellion either, but Extinction Rebellin, it looked like we were going to lose him all too soon at the tender age of just 48. He's been a professional since 1992. He's as old as the Velo d'Or, the golden bike. He's had two careers, really. One pre his doping ban and one post. One year he won the complete set, Flesh Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and the Amstel Gold Race. His team, the ePowers factory team, had failed the UCI's financial requirements for Pro Conti level next year, and it looked like he might have to retire, and that we might not see Rebellin. Well, we don't really see him, do we? He doesn't race anything we watch, but it's become one of Daniel's little pet projects, keeping tabs on Rebellin. Anyway, he's going to ride for the Cambodia Cycling Academy next year.
And then just a little bit of news that you might have missed, because it was published just before we started recording, Lionel, but the MPCC, the Movement for Credible Cycling, have requested that blood tests be carried out as close to the start of races as possible. This is in light of information that they've received from Gerb Preidler, the former FDJ and Sunweb rider who was busted for blood doping earlier this year as part of Operation Aderlass. Apparently, I don't think there's a connection here, but you'll remember at the Tour de France, I think before stage 18, the Jumbo-Visma riders, or some of them, Laurens de Ploes, George Bennett, and Stephen Kruijswijk, I believe, were blood tested on board their team bus, which nobody had ever really seen before. It was very close to the start of the stage, and it did ruffle a few feathers. I think the issue there was that they hadn't been able to blood test them at their hotel, which is more normal. They couldn't. Quickstep had also been blood tested that morning, but that's an interesting request that they've made to the authorities to carry out blood tests as close to the start of stages as possible.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by Cyclist. Cyclist, the monthly magazine. And well, Christmas is coming, and I've been humming Christmas songs in my head all morning, jingle bells going round and round in my head. And the tagline for Cyclist magazine at the moment is "Oh, what fun it is to ride," which is obviously from a Christmas song, isn't it, Richard? Even you must know that. Humbug. Look at this humbug here. Anyway, what better Christmas gift is there, either for yourself or for another cyclist in your life, than a year's subscription to Cyclist magazine for just £59.99, which is a whopping £11.89 off the shop price. That's a saving of 16%. Alternatively, you can sign up for 6 months subscription for £31.99 by going to cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast. Now, Cyclist Mag covers everything in the world of cycling, from pro racing to the best ride routes, top interviews, and well, Richard, you also feature in Cyclist magazine because you are a regular contributor. What have you been writing about this month?
I write a monthly feature for Cyclist magazine, indeed. As you say, it's got a very broad range of stuff, bikes, a lot about riding, and a bit on pro racing. And I do a sort of pro racing feature every month. The most recent one that I did was a kind of alternative review of the year, which I think you've read, Lionel.
I have indeed, yes. Very alternative it was. Yeah, you kind of tick the pro racing box, but there's a lot more to Cyclist magazine than just the pro racing. The photography is fantastic as well, and when you flick through a magazine, you really want to kind of enjoy that luxurious photography on the page. And, well, a year's subscription is the gift that keeps...
Hang on, what did you think of my feature?
I thought it was very good, Richard. I thought it was excellent, particularly the little line at the end about the surgeon who operated on Chris Froome after his accident at the Critérium du Dauphiné.
That was my conspiracy theory of the year.
Yeah, well,
like a few contenders.
I won't spoil that. But yeah, a subscription to Cyclist magazine is the gift that keeps on giving, and it also gives you a whole bunch of other perks. You not only get the magazine before it appears in the shops, but you become a member of the cyclist community, and that will open up a host of exclusive offers from top cycling brands. So go to cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast and sort out a gift for a friend or a loved one without having to even visit the shops, and that just leaves you more time to go cycling.
Now, Lionel, you'll remember our show in Belfast. You made reference to some of my very impressive results that I've enjoyed on the roads of Northern Ireland as a young cyclist. I've got a couple of tweets from a chap called Peter today saying, "I made contact with the organiser of the Tour of the North. I thought they might have had a spreadsheet or some kind of accessible record of past results." Obviously very believing, very sceptical, Peter. "It seems they don't, just loads of paper. They're going to go through it for me in the new year." So I may at some stage have a piece of electronic paper with Richard Moore officially declared King of the Mountains in 96 or 97, as you couldn't remember. Don't hold your breath, sounds like a big job, but you never know. The problem with this, Peter, is it wasn't the Tour of the North, it was the Tour of Ulster. So I'm sorry about that. Your efforts have been in vain.
Oh, dear. Well, this refers to a light joke at your expense during the opening part of our show. Our backdrop was a collection of cycling jerseys, the first of which was the yellow race winner's jersey from the 1996 Tour of Speyside. And that was the final edition of that race. You won
Iconic.
It. You won it, Richard, which does make you the reigning... Disappointingly for me, that makes you still the reigning champion of the Tour of Speyside. If there's anyone out there in Speyside who'd like to organise a race...
for in the Tesco car park.
...for 2020, I will help in any way I can. I just want to see that title, that accolade taken away from you, Richard. But we also had your Scotland Commonwealth Games jersey from 1998. And, you gave me some duff information there about your King of the Mountains win.
No, I didn't. It was the Tour of Ulster. That's the error that this chap's made. Not the Tour of the North.
Ah, did I say the Tour of Ulster?
No, he misheard, I think. So the fault is entirely with Peter.
Oh, well, there we are. Sorry about that, Peter. I should have perhaps made myself a bit clearer. But
I don't think it's fine.
Just the idea of a 90-plus kilogram man winning a King of the Mountains title.
Well, it wasn't 90-plus kilograms at the time. It was 20 kilograms ago, It reminds me of a joke in that book by Adam Kay, This Is Going to Hurt, when he's speaking to a patient who's maybe slightly overweight and saying you should go maybe do some exercise, maybe go to a gym, and she says, I am already the member of a gym, but I haven't been in 3,000 pounds.
Oh, very good.
Anyway, let's hear from Adam Blythe, who did a couple of events with us and spoke about retirement. He's still quite young, 29, but he is retiring after a year with Lotto Soudal, and it is very interesting to hear the reasons behind that and his plans now going into the future. Obviously did a lot of media this year, including a series of interviews for the Cycling Podcast at the start of the year. Some of them were excellent, and thoroughly recommend. I think the Tesh Benoit one was a standout one for me, but he's got a career in the media ahead of him, I think, as well as other bits and pieces. So here, I sat down with him before our show in Manchester, and here's what he said. Adam, here we are in the RNCM, just before curtain up. But I want to speak to you about retirement. You told us the other night about how you sort of came to this realisation this year, because a year ago we spoke to you about this season, and obviously it was a new start for you at Lotto Soudal, working with Caleb Ewan again, and you know there were possibilities for you out there. What sort of happened this year that you know brought you to the realization that it was time to stop?
It wasn't so much a realization that I had to stop. I think I could have kept going, but I chose for me what was more important, and we've just had two more kids. And for me at the time, which is now, they're a lot more important than my cycle. I can jump on a bike whenever I want. But I can't support my wife when I'm in wherever it is in the world. So that was it, really. And it wasn't the kids that made me stop. It's just that I wanted to do more with them. I wanted to spend more time with them. And it was obviously hard for my missus when I was away. So it was that kind of realisation of my time, really. It was going into them and what I wanted to put into my cycle. I couldn't do it anymore. So it just made me resent going on the bike. I used to go on the bike training, and I knew I had to do it, but I just didn't want to do it whatsoever. I was just going out, and I was like, oh God, this is just horrific. And if I had 4 hours to do with some efforts in it, I'd just always be like, oh, I'll do that tomorrow sort of thing.
Was that a big change? Have you, I mean, in the past, were you somebody who quite relished training?
No, never. I never enjoy the process of it. I never enjoy training where you got to go out, you got to do these efforts. The whole process of training, I just didn't enjoy. So training to me, I've always not really enjoyed. I've liked going out on my bike and having fun, and it's always a lot more fun when you're fit. But not really. You know, I think for me, when I was really good, I just have to pick a target and try and peak for it. And a bit like nationals this year, really. I know I was 15th or something, so not a great result, but I did that off maybe like, I don't know, 2 months of 12 to 15 hour week. So if I did put in work, I know I could have been up there, but at the same time, I was just like, oh God, I really, it's not that I don't want to do it, but I just can't enjoy going out and hurting myself anymore. So that was the realisation, really. And as we spoke about last week, I went up to Rod's house to ask him for a contract. And on
this
the
was
way,
Rod Ellingworth, when, yeah, when you, when he was appointed manager of Barry Merida.
Yeah. So I went out on the bike one day. He doesn't live far away. I spoke to him on the phone. I said, oh, can I come up and have a chat with you about the future, this, that, and the other? And he's like, yeah, sure, come on in. And on the way there, out of all people, me and Rod have had a bit of we've got a past, we're fine together now, and we get on quite well, so it's fine. But on the way there, I was just like, well, thinking about it now, if there's one person I could have lied to and been like, I'm going to do this, this will be fine, I'll help carve this, that, and the other, it would have been Rod. But on the way up there, I was just like, God, I don't even think I can bullshit my way into this, you know. He'll just see me sitting there going, I'm going to be great, don't worry about a thing, sort of thing. So he was the first person that I sort of told and came to grips with. And like Rod said, then I think once you get to that point where you accept it, you sort of have to stop in a way, because the more you fight against it, the harder it'll be. But
so you rode up there, well, you set out with the intention of asking him for a contract, but yeah, almost had a conversation with him that maybe crystallized your own thinking, did it?
A little bit, yeah, in a way. I think I just, when I was there, I just said, I'm really sorry, I feel like I'm wasting your time, but I've just realized on the way here that I don't want to be a pro bike rider anymore. And he was like, oh right, he didn't really know what to say. And then we just went through into his little office in his house, and we just had a nice chat really about cycling, what it's like retiring, and just thinking about the process, because obviously they were my first thoughts. So yeah, we just had a chat about the process really, and how we think it could go. And obviously I'd done a lot of commentary, so I think I'll be fine. I've got a couple of jobs already, which is nice. But yeah, I'm a lot happier retiring. It's on my terms. I know there's a lot of people this year that have had to retire when they want to keep going, like Russ Downing. He's 104 now. Sorry, Russ. But no, I think it's nice, but I'd do it on my own terms. I think it'll be a lot harder if I still believed I could do more, which I kind of do in a way, but I just know it'll take so much out of me that I'll end up hating myself, I think.
How hard was it to see out the season, to go to races, having, you know, feeling that maybe your heart wasn't in it anymore?
To be honest, I didn't have to do a lot of racing. The team was so supportive of me this year, and I can't fault them at all. I didn't race a lot, and some people might say, oh, it's terrible of the team, but I never asked to do a race. They didn't phone me and said, can you come and do a race? I think they knew that family life was very hard throughout the year for me, and a lot harder than I ever let on to anyone in the public.
You got your twins and another very young child as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that really took its toll on my partner. It's not been an easy time for her whatsoever. So I just, that was my main thing. I just support her, support the kids, and there's nothing more important than them in my life. So the team were very supportive of that. So I didn't really have to race a lot, and I got called up. I thought my season was done. I was meant to ride Tour of Britain, and I think 3 weeks before they said, look, I'm sorry, we're going to put you on the reserve list. And I was like, right, I completely understand. I can't argue with it. And then from then on, really, as soon as they said that, I was like, right, like, that's it. If they're not going to race me here, then they're not going to race me anywhere. But lo and behold, they put me in Paris Tours. So yeah, got a shock. I literally, since Tour of Britain, I didn't touch my bike. I didn't even look at it. And then coming up to Paris Tours, I was like, right, shit, I need to do something here. So I rode my bike once for an hour. went and did Paris Tours. But amazingly, this is what really frustrates me a little bit, because if I look back now, I'm just like, what the fuck is everyone doing with their life? Like, come on, be better. I got 120k in, made the first echelon when it split, and then obviously got dropped from it, so my form was terrible. But the most important thing about that day, I made the front split. So there was only like 20 guys in there, and I was one of them, and then poof, I got hooped after about a k later. But
you always knew how to sniff out an echelon, didn't you?
Exactly. But I was so happy with like doing that, and I think just doing that as my last race, and Yellow Ice won, which was always good. It was nice to go back and sort of finish. But then I got an email about a week later, Caleb Ewan asked if I wanted to go to Shanghai with him and do the crit. So then that was officially then my last race, which I got a top 10 in.
How did that feel? Did it feel like a significant moment? Was there a party? Was there any kind of, because a lot of riders talk about retiring or even just moving teams, that there's no ceremony to it. You know, they're just, that's it, cheerio.
Not really, no, but going back on the team thing, this is what really annoys me about teams, and it always has since I was with BMC. They've always said, this is a family, this is a family. And you hear so many teams say it, and it's bullshit. It really annoys me, though, because it's like, it's not your family, is it? Because if it was your family, you give them an 8-year contract until the end of the team's contract if he was in your family. It's not. You just get along well and you're really good at your job, and it is a job. Sorry, what was your question? But yeah, I'm just stating.
Well, how did it feel? Did it feel for you like this is the end of a chapter for me? Did you feel like this is it? You know, because you've devoted, you know, I don't know, 15 years to this sport.
Not really, no. I didn't think it was an end of a chapter. I think at the tour and after the Nationals, I came to grips with it. Even at the Giro a little bit, I kind of came to grips with it. It was a shame that I couldn't go out and really celebrate with all my mates and have a big retirement party. But all my close friends, you know, Ben Swift, Ian Stannard, Cav, all these, like, I had a 30th recently and they all came up to it. And it was just nice to have all my close friends there. And I think, you know, the people that were invited to that, a lot of them couldn't make it, but there's only like 25 of my mates there or something, but they're mates that I'll always stay in contact with. So having a big retirement party with loads of people there is kind of pointless, because I probably won't speak to them again, as awful as that sounds. But that's back on the whole family thing. It's a load of rubbish.
So how does it feel being a retired bike rider? Have you come to terms with that?
It's hard work, actually. I had to do a spreadsheet the other day for work, which took me about 4 hours just to make the boxes. it's so good and so exciting. I think working with, it got announced the other day that I'll be working with Genesis, and I never got to ride with them when I was a professional, which is a bit of a shame now I look back, but they've always helped me through my career. So riding with them and Kelly Parsons, who looks after me, it's exciting because as a pro bike rider, you're so limited to what you can do and use, and it's so stupid how, I remember when I rode for Tinkoff, I said, oh, can I have a specialised mountain bike to go on? Yeah, here's the price list. And it's like, I'm sorry, but we're professionals in this sport. Like, surely you can give each rider on this team the top of the range mountain bike and give it back like we do throughout the year. But anyway, that never happened. And with Kelly, I think I've got 8 bikes at home now. Sorry, no one, if anyone knows my address, don't go and look around. But yeah, I think I've got 8 bikes at home, and I've got like bikes that range from like an e-bike with a cargo thing in front. I've got 2 cross bikes, a gravel bike, a mat, 3 mountain bikes, road bike. And it's just like this, in my eyes, what feeling like a professional is, just like unlimited bike stuff. So that is so cool riding for them. And with Chapter 3, I'm going to design my own kits and clothing lines and stuff, which is amazing and so cool. But they're really...
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I don't think it'll be what you expect, to be honest. I think it's we've got to sell it. It's not just me buying it, we've got to sell it. So it's going to be
something a bit more sober.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a bit like that yellow and purple thing up there, the ADR jersey. God, it looks good, doesn't it, really, when you look at it compared to like boring stuff. So yeah, I'm going to do that, but that is more of a uni degree for me doing this. I know that sounds stupid, but I'll be working with the marketing manager there and closely with one of the owners, and they really want to just help me in life, develop a few new skills and not just be a cyclist, learn about marketing, learn about product design, learn about the ins and outs of a company in clothing. So I'm very grateful to them for taking it on, but it's, like I said about the spreadsheet thing a minute ago, it's just, if I showed you like what I did, you'd be like, this must have taken like 10 minutes, Adam, but it literally took me about an hour and a half, and that's when I realised, I was like, shit. This is like real life. This is completely different. So it is going to be challenging, but I'm excited for it.
And media work as well, I guess. I mean, you were on Eurosport a lot this year, cycling podcast this year as well. But that's an area, I guess, you want to develop.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something that I enjoy doing. It's something I can hope I can do more. I'm just waiting to hear back from Eurosport and the budgets, apparently. I'm not expensive.
really cheap. And when you look back in your career, I mean, we asked you to bring in a few of your old jerseys tonight, and you've brought in 3 variations of your national champions jersey, which suggests that's the result. That's the thing that you probably look back on with the greatest pride, is it?
Yeah, it definitely is, for sure. I think just wearing that jersey for a whole year and being proud of it and being able to That's why I bought the aqua blue one in, because it was almost, I didn't design it, but I just said I want minimal, this is really bad, but I want minimal sponsors on it, and I want it as white as you can make it. And they did exactly that. And that was just a kick. So I think nowadays I've got a Tinkoff jersey here, which, yeah, didn't, I only had one of them, like one short sleeve, and that was it. Such a shame that you can't have such a prestigious jersey and you can't sort of have it how you want to have it almost. It's so dictated by the team. So, yeah, that's why I brought them in, really. And because I've just moved house recently and I can't find a load of other jerseys.
Yeah, Adam really added something to our second show in London and also our show in Manchester, didn't he? You're right, he has got a career in the media ahead of him if he wishes. I mean, he's already established himself as part of Eurosport's The Breakaway crew. He did. I think he was joking. He said that he's moved outside of our, you know, outside of our financial reach in the last few months. That possibly is true. I don't know, but we'd certainly like to hear from him on the podcast again. And well, when I was kind of reviewing his career and looking at, you know, the teams that he's ridden for, BMC Racing, Orica Green Edge,
Tinkoff,
of course, then the Aqua Blue experience, and then having started at Silence Lotto, going back to Lotto Soudal for a year that didn't really turn out the way he probably anticipated at the start of the year. The sense of knowing that his time was up just because he didn't want to do professional cycling anymore. I think, you know, I've said this before, but it's really easy to take for granted that the riders all get the opportunity to choose when they want to step away, and I think it's actually quite a blessing to be able to call time on your own career, because either you've found something else that you want to do, or you've just decided you don't want to do it anymore, rather than kind of just carrying on as a professional rider because you've got no other real options. And I hope he reflects on a career that included a number of high spots. I mean, we talked in Manchester, didn't we, about how if Mark Cavendish perhaps had followed him in the finale of the World Championships in the desert, he might have won the rainbow jersey for a second time. Who knows? Obviously, the British title means an awful lot to Adam. And, well, he's retired with a wealth of very amusing stories. So when we're on tour again, it would be great to have him along again.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our sponsor, Science in Sport, for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast and their support of you in your winter training. You can get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. That's SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. Look who we found, Lionel. It's Daniele Fribarincini.
Is he there?
I'm here.
Is he there?
Yeah, you can't see me, but I'm here. I'm in the ether. Yes.
Daniel, you went missing, but we've located you.
Yes. A bit of confusion about time differences, wasn't there?
Well, Daniel, we've already done our news roundup. Any stories? I think there are maybe a couple of stories that have grabbed your attention that maybe didn't grab our attention.
Well, this news about the Poggio, landslides on the Poggio, possibly jeopardising the Poggio's, the Poggio being on the route of San Remo next year. I mean, the stuff I've read, what really struck me was how much it's going to cost to repair the damage, and millions of euros, which would make one think that there is a real danger that the Poggio won't be on the route of Milan-San Remo next year. However, we've heard and we've had scenarios before where, this is an area of Italy, a coastline that's very very much exposed to this sort of issue, and at times it has, you know, affected the race. At other times, they've managed to make necessary repairs in time. And there are other options if the Poggio wasn't ready for the race in March. There was the climb that was mooted for many years, and I think it was around about 2012, 2013. It really looked as though it was finally going to be inserted into the route to make the race harder, La Pompeiana. That didn't happen. Again, I think that was to do with with landslides and so forth. The reason why it didn't actually get its sort of world premiere. But then, you know, there were a few, we've had a few quite exciting Milan San Remos, and I think a sort of consensus has developed again that the race doesn't need toughening up, certainly in terms of extra climbs, but that would be an option. That would come after the Cipressa, most likely. So you could have Cipressa and then Pompeiana. I say this, I don't know whether the road to the Pompeiana has also been affected by the landslides. If that particular modification was to be an option, so Cipressa, Pompeiana, no Poggio, and then obviously it would obviously be further to San Remo from the bottom of the descent of the Pompeiana than it is from the Poggio. And then I think you, paradoxically, you would probably see a greater likelihood of a big bunch sprint, even though the Pompeiana is considerably harder than the Poggio, simply because you'd be looking at sort of 10, 15 kilometres, something of that nature, before the race arrived in San Remo. So yeah, interesting. And we're following the sort of local news over the next few weeks. But you know, there's a reasonable amount of time. It must be about 14 weeks or so.
Well, we speculated that it might, you know, alter the you know, the sort of rider who might fancy it. If there's a change to the course, it would be a shame, wouldn't it? The Poggio is such a magnificent climax to the race, and that excitement of when they hit the lower slopes and the race to the top, not always decisive, but always great to watch. So yeah, we'll watch that with interest. Any other stories?
So it's also the 2020 edition would be the 50th anniversary of the Poggio's first inclusion in Milan-San Remo as well, so if it was missed out on such a sort of landmark anniversary, that would be an added shame.
Just one other thing, not really a news item, chaps, but I've just been reading a nice interview on Tutto Bici Web with the Italian neopro guy who's going to turn pro with NTT, formerly Dimension Data, next year, Matteo Sobrero, who, napalm, is from just up the road from what was one of our favourite haunts on the Grand Tours last year, Barbaresco. He's from that region, and not only that, but his family actually are winemakers. And I think where he's from, it's Barolo they make rather than Barbaresco. But he's a sort of a punchy little climber, sort of a Kwiatkowski kind of rider. So, yeah, someone to keep our eyes on next year, I think.
There was another story, I think, that caught your eye concerning Direct Energy.
With a bit of an Italian angle, Direct Energy, as we know, in theory, they're qualified to ride the Giro d'Italia next year as the sort of best of the non-World Tour teams, rankings-wise. However, it looks as though there have been discussions between RCS Sport, the organisers of the Giro, and Jean-René Bernardeau, the manager of Direct Energy. And we think they've come to an agreement whereby Direct Energy are going to forsake their place in the Giro. And that's going to open up another spot, which will presumably go to an Italian team. This is something we've talked about a lot over the last few years, and it was a major concern among the Italian professional division teams that this was restricting them even further. They've sort of been squeezed out over the last few years with the sort of expansion of them, the consolidation of the World Tour. There have been fewer and fewer spots available for the Italian professional division teams at the Giro, and you know, we've talked a lot over the years about the sort of slow demise of Italian cycling, Italian professional cycling. It's a real concern. You know, you go back to the mid-90s and there were upward 15 teams, Italian teams, who would compete in the Giro. In the last couple of years, it's been down to two or three. So should that happen, should Direct Energy step aside, there will probably be three Italian teams at the Giro next year, or Continental Division teams. Gianni Savia will be there with Androni, Bardiani will be there, and it will probably be one other.
Interesting stuff. Well, a bit of this cycling podcast business. Few people have been asking about where they get our book. It's not currently available on Amazon or in bookshops. The Grand Tour Diaries, it's called, it was published a few weeks ago. For the moment, it's available exclusively through our website. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, click the tab book, and that will take you to the page on which to buy it. It may go on Amazon in the next week or so, but for the moment, it's just available through us. So do go there. We can post it anywhere in the world. It's £15. Next week, a lot of you have been asking about this as well, we are launching our 2020 Friends of the Podcast program with a new delivery system.
Yes, it's going to be a lot easier to use than our previous system. We've relied on, since we started the Friends of the Podcast scheme in 2015, we promised for a number of years that we would make it easier, but the technology is tricky to develop, but finally we have found a solution. Hopefully you will be able to become a friend of the podcast in a faff-free way, and hopefully that will encourage everyone who's been a friend and has enjoyed the episodes to sign up again. But hopefully it will also persuade people who've maybe been wavering to sign up as a friend of the podcast. Can't overstate the importance and our gratitude to all of our friends of the podcast, because by signing up, paying us a small amount of money, really, in the grand scheme of things.
Price is frozen for 2020.
Price is frozen, and the delivery system is improved. So £15, a minimum of 11 special episodes will be released over the years, plus other goodies as and when. But the income that generates is really, really important to us when it comes to providing so many free episodes throughout the course of the year. So we're not just offering. And we're not just asking for money, we're offering something in exchange. And the first episode, Richard, is ready to go. I've been listening to it this morning on my way here. I'm going to carry on listening to it this afternoon. But grit so far.
Well, it's a look at stage 19 of this year's Tour de France, the one that went over the Col de l'Isère and had to be cancelled. I've spoken to Egan Bernal, who was leading at the time. Seb Piquet, who was in the car following the Voice of Race Radio, of course. And the second part of the episode is a sort of focus on Bernal, a longer interview with him, with his coach, Xavi Arteta, with his teammate Theo Gegenhardt, with Gianni Savio, the man who discovered him. He's brilliant, Savio. At one point I asked him a question, and he prefixed his answer with anecdote, lining up his anecdote. And so that will be out, available next week, in next week's episode, and on social media. So we'll give you step-by-step instructions about how to sign up. So episode one will be a look back on stage 19 of the Tour de France. Episode two is going to be a kind of mashup of our live shows. We're going to hear an extended clip now, first from one of those live shows, and it's me doing my reading from the aforementioned book about stage 19. And it'll be followed by a little extract from the Bernal special as well.
Let's move on.
Let's stick with the tour. It was an amazing tour, and there were no more amazing days than the one I'm going to talk about. And the picture on the jacket of the book is from that day. Very unusual, very original to have a cycling book with a man running on the cover. I don't think that's been done before. But yeah, a very dramatic.
I think the Chris Froome album from the the year on Mont Ventoux, that he running on the cover of that thing.
So Friday the 26th of July, stage 19, Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne to Tien, 126.5 kilometres. That's actually scored out 89 kilometres. Winner, ?
Dublin won this far ahead.
I've got a good feeling about this. Yellow jersey, Egan Bernal. This has long been in
moment.
Don't interrupt. This has long been in my diary as the day I go up in a helicopter, courtesy of Skoda, who sponsor the cycling podcast Femina. I personally wouldn't go up in a helicopter, says Lionel as we drive to the start. They're very unsafe. There has never been an accident involving a helicopter at the Tour de France, I say. We'd have heard about it. But you know what this means, pipes up Francois from his nest.
that the chance of there being one increases a little every day.
Should have got the mic for that. For the rest of the journey, whenever it goes quiet, Lionel makes a choppy noise that I assume is meant to sound like a helicopter's rotors. In our Skoda VIP cars, we leave 20 minutes or so before the start, and 40 kilometres into the stage, we stop to watch the tour pass from the roadside. It's a short stage, steadily climbing pretty much all day before the monster called the Liseron, but we are standing by a roundabout where the road is flat, and you'd have thought from the way the riders are going that this was a sprinter's stage. There is an air of chaos, an atmosphere of anarchy. Irishman Dan Martin and others are off the front. The group behind is stretched in a long, fractured line and finally cast adrift and clearly struggling as one rider with a teammate. Is it Thibaut Pinot? A few minutes ago, I'd been talking about Pinot to my companions as the most likely winner of the Tour de France. What is going on? There is no time to find out. We are running Annika Rice style to our helicopter, with our pilot mentioning just as we clamber aboard that this will be her first time flying in the mountains. I normally fly tourists over Paris, she says. I'm so preoccupied by the fragments of the race that we've just seen that I have no time to worry about this. Up we go. Disgracefully, I spend much of our time in the air refreshing Twitter, trying to get updates. Here we are in a spectacular valley, mountains towering over us on each side, hovering over the race, but just far enough away to not be able to make out who is who, or more to the point, who is where. Three TV helicopters buzz around beneath us, 50 metres over the race. We are 150 metres above them, and many more hundreds of metres above us are the planes receiving the images and transmitting them. The logistics of it all, not to mention the cost and the fuel burned every day, is mind-boggling. The helicopter ride is wasted on me. I feel too disconnected. I want to get back to Earth as quickly as possible. We land at the foot of the Liseron, meet our driver Tim Harris, jump back in the car and speed away. Up the mountain we go, green, scraggy and empty, apart from thousands of fans. We crest the summit and plummet. Tim is a very fast, very skillful driver. Until at the 30-kilometre to go banner, we pull off the road to park in a little clearing. There is a caravan and an awning and trestle-style tables and chairs. And a little incongruously, Andy Schleck. But again, I am glued to my screen and the race. I prop my phone up on the table, and Tim and I watch Egan Bernal attack. Pino by now has dropped out in tears. Alaphilippe is beginning to struggle, perhaps cracking. Here then is the decisive point of the race. Bernal riding into crowds of fans on a benign day of blue skies. So much for Francois' prediction of storms. I feel a dollop of rain. The air cools dramatically and suddenly, as though a new weather system simply replaces the old one. We dash for the cars. I keep watching the race on my phone. Having stopped for lunch, we are only 30 metres or so ahead of the riders. 30 minutes or so ahead of the riders. 30 metres would be ridiculous. Tim, whose daily challenge is to keep just ahead of the race, steps on the accelerator and we carry on descending. The sky turns dark grey. Proper rain begins to fall, rapidly turning into hailstones. Not hailstones, that doesn't do them justice. They're like mini boulders. That's what they sound like as they ricochet off the car. I fear for the car. We enter a tunnel and the noise is turned off. What blessed relief. When we come out the other side, we're met again by the same crescendo, a noise so deafening that we can't hear each other shout. The road on this side of the tunnel is white. The hailstones have congealed, turning it into sheet ice. Most of the tour vehicles travelling ahead of the race have now stopped by the side of the road. We can only keep going because we're in a 4x4, says Tim. Look, watch this. He brakes hard and we skid. On the screen, meanwhile, Bernal is now with Simon Yates and they are approaching the summit, still in perfect weather. Yet here we are, only a few kilometres ahead in a completely different universe, the kind of hellscape that might feature in a Cormac McCarthy novel. We crawl along, but what will happen to the race? Tim slams on the brakes again. Before us, crawling across the road, is a giant, muddy, rocky tongue, a landslide. We get out to have a look. Then the landslide begins to move as if coming to life. The air fills with the sounds of panic. We scamper back to our vehicles. The route to the finish in Tien is blocked, but Tim has a look and sees an alternative road which we take. Meanwhile, Radio Tour crackles into life with the familiar but now urgent voice of Seb Piquet. Attention, attention, the stage is cancelled. All riders and teams are to stop at the summit of the Isérons. Arrangements are made to transport them to emergency accommodation in Val d'Isère. Seb relays some detailed instructions over several minutes. With the finish cancelled, Tim drops me at the foot of the climb to Tien, and the first people I see are podcast listeners who give me a friendly, morale-boosting reception. They have been here for hours waiting for the tour, and so they're obviously disappointed, but there is a strange, almost giddy atmosphere, which you often find when things have taken a spectacularly unusual turn. Our attention is then drawn by a throng of cheering people moving at walking pace towards us. Loud music is emanating from the throng, and horns are blaring, and at the centre of all the commotion are two De Koenig Quickstep people carriers. Sitting on the passenger seat of one of the cars, still in his yellow jersey, is a smiling Julian Alaphilippe. The sunroof slides open, the music gets louder, and then Alaphilippe rises up on the seat and emerges from the car like Jesus Christ or George Best. It's the last time anyone will see him in a yellow jersey at this year's tour.
I've never. Hope your cars are strong. That was incredible.
To all the teams, a very important message. Important message due to very bad weather conditions that caused the 112 heavy hail. We are forced to stop the stage.
Yeah, I didn't understand what happened at the moment because I was in the downhill already. And I heard something in the radio, but they were talking in English, and I was like really concentrated to do the downhill fast. And then I asked to Nico to explain me what was happening in Spanish, and he explained me, and you know was a little bit strange because I saw the weather and was like a sunny day, and they say that it was raining full gas in a few kilometers after.
I tell you what, I'm glad we didn't get this in the helicopter.
I think they might not have let us take off in the first place.
Whoa! And we're watching the race in the just over the hill there in perfect weather. You know, there's nothing. Little do they know what awaits them.
Well, listening to the audio, it seems that we're in a bit of a panic, but we're not. Honestly, it was very relaxed. I mean, we took the decisions when we had to take the decisions, but because we had the information well before everyone else.
Dios, sácame adelante. La voz no me puede fallar en un instante tan importante. Dame fuerzas. Egan, campeón. Colombia te ama, Egan. Colombia te ama.
Well, that was my reading from the book, The Grand Tour Diaries, an audio version of The Grand Tour Diaries will be released over the course of the year for friends of the podcast. The Giro Diaries will come out around about Christmas time. The Tour de France, the Women's Tour, and the Vuelta will follow. But yeah, episode one for friends of the podcast is a look at Stage 19 and Egan Bernal. Episode two will be the live shows. Episode three will be the Giro Diaries. We should wrap things up for this week. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
And Daniel, thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.